It's very sad.
It's completely debilitating. I mean, I talked to Mr. Martin about it, and I don't know how he didn't go completely crazy on the Park Service for what they did to him.
Right.
And he told me, he said, "Dave, this is the reason why I don't trust the press and I don't trust the government." He said, "They lied to me. They were evasive." He said, "The only guy that was even slight," he goes, "was honest to me was Dwight McCarter." He said he tried to help me understand, but even he couldn't understand why they didn't think at the beginning that this wasn't an abduction and handle it appropriately.
And on the subject of that thing that the Key family saw, I mean, any speculation on what that was? I mean, did it seem like a person, or I mean, she described it as a bear. Of course, everyone knows that the most famous cryptid is Sasquatch. I mean, it just seems very weird, but that's the only thing that it kind of seems to allude to.
So McCarter, I asked him about that, and he said, "Well," he goes, "a few years before Dennis disappeared, this was a time when the rangers were not armed in national parks." And he said a ranger was working alone in a back area of Great Smoky Mountain National Park, and he was attacked by what McCarter described as a wild man, meaning a guy living off the grid like you and me, that lived off animals, that wore furs and didn't have any ethics. And he said that this wild person attacked the ranger and almost killed him. And he said, "You know," he goes, "the only thing I could think of is that this family saw one of these wild men that lives in the parks that the Park Service doesn't want to acknowledge lives there, and maybe took Dennis." But he says it'd be conjecture at this point, but he goes, "I don't know what else to think of it."
Yeah, that's so interesting and weird. And on another radio show, I heard you talking about this case, and you had alluded to, or you just kind of mentioned in passing that there was a remote viewer report that was fairly interesting, and I was pretty intrigued by that. Do you have any details on what that remote viewer saw?
Actually, it wasn't a remote viewer, it was a psychic.
Gotcha.
He had written in to the Park Service and supplied a report that was in this massive amount of documents. And this guy had some apparent notoriety for the time and said that his mind had a difficult time going to where it was going because it was such a dark place.
Wow.
And he thought it was there was a creek nearby, there possibly was a cave, but that what was happening to Dennis was beyond the realm of his comprehension. It was along those kind of lines. Very bad, very dark, kind of almost a horrific scenario. He didn't go into much more detail than that. And I think it's interesting because we have a couple of guys that live in that area that know that park like the back of their hand, and I can tell you that we have done extensive research, and we can't find an area where there's a cave access and a creek running through it because we've made some big efforts to find it.
Man. And, I talk about a lot of paranormal concepts on this show. They come up all the time. And sometimes I wonder if there aren't some strange electromagnetic effects on the planet that we don't understand, similar to how planes fly into the Bermuda Triangle and are covered in this electric fog and are suddenly just disappeared. And it seems like some of these people just do disappear from the scene as if they walked through some type of portal or gateway, as weird as that sounds.
Oh, I've heard that theory before from probably hundreds of people. The issue I have with it is that it is a very, very underlying, very rare event when more than one person disappears like this. And you'd think if that was the scenario, we'd be losing more than one person at a time, or there would be witnesses to that other person disappearing.
Right.
And that
Yeah,
doesn't
that is
happen.
true. Yeah. Well, I mean, another thought I had is we cover a ton of conspiracies, alien abductions, Bigfoot and other cryptids, child pedophilia rings of the Vatican and political elite, all sorts of conspiracies and mysteries that insinuate missing people, but a lot of times they don't have names or anyone who's actually gone missing for these things. I wonder if some of these events aren't connected with these types of crimes and these types of things that people talk about happening.
So I can only look at it from a common sense and a factual viewpoint, and that is that many of these have occurred pretty deep in the wilderness where there's not a lot going on. And the idea that there's a human abduction process taking place, I know a lot of friends that are backpackers that carry guns. And if somebody's going to try it, you know, there's going to be some shooting going on. Mm-hmm. And you never hear about that. And what I've explained on other shows is whatever is happening here is 100% effective. Because if they weren't, we would hear about a mistake or we would hear about an attempt, and we don't hear about that.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I wanted to talk about in the next section of the next grouping of cases. I think the big commonality that I found that I kind of pulled out and wanted to talk about these ones was survivors that did have something interesting to say that was kind of weird. But I another comment I wanted to make is I heard you talk about on another show, because you've gotten a lot of attention for this work, is MUFON had taken a little interest in your work as well, and I was wondering if there was any kind of development with that at all.
You know, I think that it touches on an area in MUFON, just so people know, Mutual UFO Network.
Yes.
It touches on an area there that I think it may make some people very uncomfortable. In the same way the National Park Service has Smokey the Bear, you know, come to the park and meet our friendly bear and he'll hug you and he's friendly. I think there's some, not all, but some in the MUFON community that think that abduction process is always a two-way street, meaning that they believe that you're abducted and you come back. And anything outside of that realm makes them feel very uncomfortable.
Mm.
And when you start, there's a guy named John Mack that the people, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, Greg?
Yeah, I have.
So John Mack, psychiatrist at Harvard, a professor, wrote some great books and did some superb research into abductions. And he substantiated in his mind that there was something here that needed to be investigated more, because the stories of the people and what happened to them were way, way too similar for them to all know the specific facts that everyone was saying. And unfortunately, he died in an accident in Europe, but his work, I think, substantiated what was mostly unsubstantiated before, in that there were these underlying elements, just like we've identified, that occur in the abduction process. And if the possibility existed that someone, something, somewhere, somehow was taking people and not returning them, that's a pretty dark thing.
It is. It is. It's scary.
It is scary. And I think some that study that area don't even like the association.
Yeah, it's a strange field. There are people who are convinced, even so, that all the extraterrestrials must be good, you know, and it's like, if there are intelligent beings out there, you'd expect their personalities to be just as vast as humans, ones with good intentions, ones with negative intentions. So it is weird to accept such a far out topic and possibility, but yet be so narrow-minded as to how you accept that possibility. It's a little silly.
And what I can tell you is that I've been invited to talk in front of many MUFON groups across the U.S. I have never been invited to talk at a national conference.
It's funny when things go to that national level, to that high-end level, sometimes they change. But So let's go over some of these cases where kids or people came back with interesting stories. One that I liked, it's a little anomalous because it's in Wentzville, Missouri, in the middle of the country. Usually these are on the East or West Coast. Well, I guess they're everywhere, but a lot of the ones you focus on are in big foresty type parks like in Oregon and Washington and California. But I'm from Missouri. I grew up there, and Wentzville's right in between the college town of Columbia and St. Louis. And I've driven through there probably 100 times in my life. So this one was kind of interesting to me. But I guess Tristan Owens, young kid, 2 years old in the year 2005, not that long ago.
No, October 2005. And so maybe you could kind of tell us what that community is like, Greg. Is it a swampy area? Is it thick with forests around it? Explain it.
No, I mean, I would say, of course, just driving through it on the highway, it seems like a regular suburb, you know, just a real typical suburban Midwest community, not really anything super strange about it. I don't think there's a lot of places for people to go missing, although I haven't gotten really into the backwoods of Wentzville, but it seems like it's a pretty out in the open place.
So Tristan, the family lived, I guess, on the outskirts of the community, kind of near a wild area, but Tristan's playing in the yard. And again, he's playing with the family's Jack Russell Terrier. His mom, Stacy Owens, goes in the house for just a couple of minutes, she says. She returns back to the yard, and Tristan and the dog are gone. Now, if you're gone for that period of time, your voice should be able to carry far enough to pick up a 2-year-old boy and his dog.
Yeah, you'd think.
And Tristan didn't respond, and the dog didn't respond. So she looks, and she gets some neighbors to help, and an hour later they call the police and the sheriff, and they respond out. And a big search, and the searchers, they're looking around till midnight. They're calling the boy's name. They're not getting anything. And that disturbed them a lot because they didn't think that Tristan could get that far, and they thought that the dog would respond to the mom's calls to come back, and neither did. So the fire department, the sheriff's office, everybody calls their people in, and two firefighters decide to stay in the woods, and they were going to stay out there and try to hear anything, smell anything, just try to be the eyes and ears out there as late as they could stay out. And as they're out there, they hear a scream in the woods, and then they think that they hear coyotes that are yapping at each other that are slowly converging on this one area. And they describe the conditions as being dense fog in that area. Again, another weather-related anomaly.
Right, interesting.
And as they're walking through the woods, they see that the coyotes are converging on this area they're walking towards. And as the firefighters describe it, it's like they walked right up to Tristan standing right in front of him. And he says, "Well, will you take me to my home?"
Huh.
And they said that the boy had scrapes on his face, but nothing really highly unusual. And later on in discussions, the mom said that she thought that he was really scared and was only giving bits and pieces of the story, but not the whole story. And other than that, he said that he woke up in the woods. And I think that's an interesting point because he didn't say he walked into the woods and went to sleep and woke up. He said he woke up in the woods.
Yeah.
A slight difference there in semantics and in an understanding, but there's a lot of these cases where the kids disappear, don't respond to family calls, no canines can pick up a scent, so you wonder how they can get out of the area as quick as they do without leaving a scent for bloodhounds and things to find them.
Very weird. It doesn't make any sense to me. Man, yeah, that's that one being from the Midwest, it was one of the few ones that I was just like, wow, that's very weird. So we have talked about, and we are going to talk about more people that actually lived, but a lot of people don't. They either find the body or they don't find anything at all. And I was wondering, I mean, because you've looked at so many cases, to get a better idea of the scope, if you had to try to break it down roughly by percentage into the three categories of person found alive, person found dead, and person never found, can you give us any kind of idea of the cases you're looking at, what kind of ratios there are there?
This would be a guess, but I'm going to guess it's 50% are found alive, 25% are found dead, 25% are never found.
Yeah.
That would be a loose interpretation, you know. But
sure, yeah.
I'm kind of thinking that that's it. But again, the vast majority of the times are just like Tristan's, where when the people are found, it's a rarity when they can explain what happened. Many times they can't explain how they got to where they were. In a rare event, they can explain what happened when they got where they were, but they can't explain how they got to or from the location. In the vast majority of the times, if it's a small child, the parents say that they're scared and they don't want to talk, or they know more, but they're not saying it. I mean, it's almost as though their memory got taken from them, or they're so scared about what happened, they don't even want to tell their parents.
Yeah, that is very weird. You would think a kid would be able to tell their parents, and that's one of those commonalities. And it's kind of in line with what happens with UFO abductions or with stories of the Bermuda Triangle. People say they go into a fog and they just get completely disoriented and don't know where they are, and they appear somewhere else if they're lucky. But yeah, not knowing what happened to you is just the weirdest part. Another one of these ones, and I should say, these ones that we're talking about that people did live, and the details they have in almost all the cases, they're different, but they're very minor. You don't get a full story in any of these cases, and that's the trippy thing. People live through it. The only one who can tell us something, and yet they got nothing to say. But this Katie Flynn girl, she was a pretty interesting case. It had a little bit of detail to something she experienced while she was out there.
Before you touched on something that's
sure.
pretty key, is these books have been all over the world. I mean, you can buy them on Amazon in Europe, but there's a man in Finland that took a keen interest in this, and he had communicated with me off and on in the previous 3 years, and he was looking into an area that I never even thought to look in, but you brought it up, and that was the Bermuda Triangle. And he said that since we started flying into the triangle, there's, I think, 126 different planes that have flown in and never have been found.
Right.
Completely disappeared. And he wrote me a letter and he said, Dave, here's the website that keeps track of that. And he says, I want you to know that five people that you've written about have disappeared on the same day that one of these planes disappeared.
No.
And I thought, wow.
Yeah.
Because at that time, there were 600 people that we had written about and identified. 126 planes in, I think it was 75 years, and then 600 people in 125 years. If you look at the statistical odds of five in that time frame matching five planes, it's phenomenal.
Right.
So, yeah, we did confirm that is true what he said. And
oh, man.
We went back in and started to look at aerial issues related to missing people. And we found five cases where search and rescue was looking for one of the people that we had identified, and either a helicopter or a plane crashed in conjunction with the search.
Wow. That's an interesting commonality. Man, this little thread makes me think about the show Lost, if you ever watched it, where this island just kind of disappears and reappears on some type of electromagnetic, natural, semi-natural time clock. And it's just a weird thought of, like, maybe the static charge of the Earth just kind of hiccups for a second, and people in the Bermuda Triangle get confused, people in Yosemite get confused. I don't know.
Yeah, it's very strange, but I got to give this guy in Finland credit for coming up with the five planes and the five people, because it's someplace we would have never looked.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's something that you can't ignore, just because the odds that there's five helicopters or planes that also crashed in conjunction with searching, that's a pretty big percentage when you look at the number of times and the number of cases.
It is, yeah. Definitely an interesting thread to explore.
Yeah, right. So, again, when you try to stick with the facts, the more facts you can generate, usually it'll eventually lead to a solution, hopefully. But I don't want people to think that we're trying to grasp every straw, but we're trying to understand how every piece to this puzzle may fit together.
Oh, of course. I mean, the things that are happening are so mysterious that you have to look at those crazy possibilities because all the rational ones have been eliminated.
Right, right. And what I tell people is once you start to eliminate and say, well, I'm not going to look at that, then you're not really investigating anymore.
Good point. Right. You got to be open. Got to be open-minded.
Yeah. Anyhow, getting back to Katie Flynn for you.
Yes, yes.
So this is one of the older cases that we looked at the time. We've gone back to all the way to 1760 on a couple. This one occurred in 1868 in Walhalla, Michigan. She was 3 years old, and their dad owned a lumber camp. And there was a small hill. This part of Walhalla, it's generally a pretty flat area, but there's this one hill, and he was taking lumber off the hill. And Katie would ride with he and the horses down the hill into an area where he pulled the logs. And then she'd walk back up the hill to meet the dad when he came back up. This had gone on for days. And she knew the drill, and dad said he made dozens and dozens of trips. Well, on this one trip, he comes back up the hill. She's not there. And he gets a couple other men, and they start searching. And unbelievably, as they're searching, two other guys come up that are hunters, and they also start helping them search. And so all four of the men are working their way through the woods. And it was on the second or the third day that they're quite a distance from the camp, and they're in kind of a marshy area. And they hear something, like a small cry. And they're quiet, and they start working their way through the woods. And what they saw, what they described as a huge, what they thought was a bear, jump from this log into the river and disappear. And as they walk up, they find Katie standing on this log. Now, this is after 2 or 3 days. So dad picks up Katie, starts going back to camp, and they have that quiet moment. And he says, well, what happened? And she lays the story out where she was playing in the sandbox waiting for him to get back up the hill. And this big dog, she describes it as a giant dog, comes up and starts playing with her in the sandbox. And eventually stands up like a person, puts its hand or its paw out, and they kind of walk off. And she's not sure where they're walking, but they walk off together. Eventually they walk off into the woods. So later on in the night, she gets hungry. So the dog kind of indicates that she needs to stay there, and he comes back, and in its paws, it's got like a handful of berries that he gives to her.
Weird.
The whole thing's weird. And eventually, that night, it gets a bunch of leaves together on the ground and makes a bedding area, and then cuddles with her as they sleep that night away. And the dad asks her, well, what happened to your hat? And she says, well, the dog grabbed it off my head and ate it. Huh. And he says, the dog ate your hat. Yeah. And the dad and the other men know what they saw. And I guess in their minds, they said it could have been a big dog, but it would have been one of the biggest dogs they ever saw. But this article got huge play in 1868. It was in almost every newspaper in the United States just because there were multiple men that saw the same thing and recovered the girl unharmed from the presence of this apparently huge mammal. I don't know what to make [S2] Jeez. [S1] Of it other than I will say that area of Walhalla has had many, many, many strange things happen at it and around it in the last 150 years.
Wow. And that also kind of touches on the description of the creature that the Keyes family saw with the Dennis Martin case. It seems to be a similar description.
You know, I wouldn't say no, but could be.
And these next two that I have kind of lined out, both have given very small details, but the detail seems to be somewhat similar. But the first one would be this 9-year-old kid, Roger Schadinger, in Truckee, California. He was found under an interesting circumstance.
Yeah, Roger. May 27th, 1951, he was 9 years old. He and his family took a trip from San Diego to go fishing. If people know Truckee, that's the area where the Donner Lake is very, very close and where the Donner Party spent that winter. Its elevation's about 6,600 feet, and Alder Creek in Placer County was their destination. And they're fishing, and the dad loses sight of Roger, starts yelling for him, screaming for him. Again, it's one of those things where all of a sudden it seems like the boy's gone. And the father gets help. Placer County Sheriff's, Highway Patrol, everyone starts to come into the area. And they're searching up and down this creek bank. And they're thinking, well, this is going to be a quick search, but it wasn't. They bring in a special Indian tracker from Stillwater, Nevada. And this Indian tracker had found some boys before that were hard to find. And the tracker ends up finding Roger 28 hours after he disappeared at an elevation of 7,600 feet, so 1,000 feet higher than where he disappeared. And when the boy was talked to by his parents, he said that he was hiding from, quote-unquote, the people. And he said that he thought that they were going to do him harm. And the other point was is that Roger was found without his shoes, and nobody really could understand that. There is one other story I've written about, a story named about a disappearance of a small boy named Dana Cooper that disappeared in August 1971, about 20 years after Roger, about 10 miles away. Dana had a disability, disappeared under really, really unusual circumstances. And then there's also a disappearance of James Bordenkircher from North Lake Tahoe, June of 65, that Bordenkircher was never found. So in this general area, there's been a lot of really, really weird disappearances.
Yeah, I would say so. Hiding from the people. It just sounds like something written out of a B-level horror movie, you know, just something super vague and ominous and scary. But this woman, Linda Ortega, she disappeared, and she had similar statements when she was found, correct?
Almost exactly, word-wise. She, 53 years old, in an area near St. Joe, Arkansas, kind of north-central Arkansas, an area where there have been other disappearances before. September 22nd, 2012, she and her brother were out looking for a fishing hole in the woods. Somehow or another, she got separated, and she went missing for 5 days. And when she was eventually found by some guys on an ATV, she was missing her shoes, and she was in fair condition, not great condition, but she was taken to the hospital. Doctors talked to her, and she told the doctor that she had seen people in the woods, strange people. She described them as weird, that were hiding behind bushes, and she would talk to them, trying to get them to help her, but they wouldn't help her. And the doctor made a special statement in one of the articles that he thought she was cogent, speaking the truth, and would have no reason to lie. And if you look at the number of stories, just like you've identified here, where people say similar things, it's a hard thing to ignore, because it appears as though they're seeing something.
Very weird. That was something I just thought was so interesting, because you got these people that are describing what seems to be intelligent beings, whether they're dog-like or bear-like or the people. It's at least something, you know, it's something to go on that alludes to an interaction. And that doesn't even mean that these cases, even though they have similar commonalities amongst the disappearances, it doesn't mean that the same explanation is responsible for all these. That would be almost impossible with the number of cases you've covered, which throws another wrench in the whole investigation, is that this is probably several weird things happening.
Exactly. And we talk about this amongst ourselves. We always say, okay, so these are a few articles where the reporter has taken a risk to talk about something highly unusual. But how many times does a victim say something unusual and the reporter redacts it and doesn't include it?
Oh, great point. Yeah, that probably happens more often than not. That's why we have so few of those details.
True. And then the other point is that how many times does the child, let's say, have an unusual event and something strange happened to them, and they don't really know the reporter, so they're not going to tell him anything, but the reporter leaves, the police leave, and that night in the privacy of your own home, the parents just told a story that's so unbelievable that they don't even want to talk about it, and they keep it to themselves because they think it's, you know, maybe something's wrong with my child because they said this, but in reality, there could be 50 cases of that in the U.S. where all the kids are saying the same thing.
Right. Man. And I love to try, I love the mystery of it. I'm going to throw something out to you. You can throw it back if you'd like, but I don't know if you've looked into this at all. This is a pretty out there idea, and a lot of people are found, so this wouldn't apply to those cases. But a guy, Richard Sauter, and several other researchers have done a lot of work in secret underground bases that are out there. And there's a ton of them in the U.S., apparently. And a researcher I know quite well, Olav Phillips, he wrote a little piece about your work and kind of showed the clusters of people going missing and also these areas of underground bases that are supposedly out there. And some of them seem to overlap quite a bit. Now, that could just be because those are both remote areas. So if you were going to have a secret base, it would probably be in a secret area like that, in a secluded area. But also, you know, these missing people, I mean, it there could be a connection there. Have you explored that possibility at all?
Truthfully not, but we've heard the theory before. And again, so I try to keep an open mind on most things.
Right.
But on secret bases where we supposedly know where they're at, then we should be able to at least find something that points that there's something unusual occurring at that location. So if that's true, then why can't people walk us up there and point it out?
Maybe it's something that the people in that camp and the people in your camp haven't gotten together a lot, but yeah, I mean, not the best answer, but it's something I found kind of curious. And again, so many people end up alive and no one says that they were taken to a secret base somewhere, but it's just a weird thread I thought we might talk about. But
now Greg, I'll also give you that. I mean, I've been doing this for 5 years now, so I probably have heard every theory imaginable.
Oh, sure.
And the theories range all the way from reptoids to aliens to Bigfoot to serial killers. I mean, it just, oh, there's also fairies and little people. So, and you got to understand, I'm not discounting anything, but the rational side of me says, okay, if it's going to be A, if that's the suspect people are pointing to, then point me to somebody who's, say, seen one. And let's just say it's Bigfoot. So there's thousands of sightings, and there's hundreds of people that have credible written all over them that will say that they've seen one.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you jump over to reptoids, I challenged one person. I said, just introduce me to somebody who's seen one then.
Right, true.
So, and then you can go, I spent time on a Native American reservation, and you could talk to Native Americans who say that there really are little people out there in the woods that are like wild people.
Yeah.
So I could pinpoint those people and talk to those witnesses. And then, of course, you know, there's millions of people that'll say that they were abducted and they've seen aliens. So I'm not saying that anyone is more credible than another, but that rational, common sense side of me says, okay, then let's take it a step further in my understanding and introduce me to those people that have had that experience.
Right. Yeah, it's you're right. It's a little out there, but you can these cases are pretty out there too. And I got three more that I hope we can get to. These ones are not really connected at all. They're just thrown in at the end for their strange details that are just very weird. One of them would be Betty Waldrum. She disappeared, and some interesting things happened along the way, right?
So our cousins up in Canada, there have been many strange incidents that have happened up there that fit the profile of what we're looking at. About 120 miles northwest of Winnipeg in a small little town called Moosehorn. She was 4 years old. This happened in 1934, May 15th. She lived on a farm. And let me say that she was German, and her family was German. And when there is nationality spoken about in articles, which it is rare, German seems to come up a lot. More common than most. And I think that's something that we've started to pay more attention to. We don't understand it, but she was German and her family was German and they spoke German. And she lived on this farm, and one day she just went missing and her parents lost track of her. There was a huge 5-day search by farmers, friends, nothing. There were heavy rains in the area right after she disappeared. And there was an appeal made to the community, like, if she's there, we've got to find her soon, otherwise she's not going to make it, blah, blah, blah. Well, there was a nearby farmer called Roy Rosin, R-O-S-I-N, and he told himself one day, he says, you know, I'm gonna find her, and if I'm going to go anywhere, I'm going to go to this location on my farm, about 2 miles away from the Wolfram farm. And he walked out to this location. He found her. She was semi-conscious. He carried her home. A doctor saw her hours after she was found, said she wasn't dehydrated. She hadn't lost a lot of weight, some. And the key point to this doctor was there were no mosquito bites on her, and there were tons of mosquitoes outside. Her shoes were clean, and her clothing was fairly clean. And when she was interviewed, she hardly said a word. And as this is going on, and after this starts to make news in the community, another nearby farmer says, well, this is really weird, but this farmer wasn't directly next to where she disappeared, but he said that somehow or another, one of his cows had been milked several times in the general time frame that she had disappeared. Well, the RCMP got suspicious of Rosin, because he told people that he was going to this one area off his farm. And he told the RCMP that this was a hunch that she would be in this area. And he said, you know, I'm either going to come back dead, or I'm not going to come back and I'll be dead. Or if I went out there, I was going to get beaten to a pulp. I didn't know, but luckily I brought her back. And that's about all he would say. And the interesting point is just what I said earlier. Every once in a while, there's a tidbit in an article that'll raise your interest, but there's not enough there really to say what happened or what his thinking was. But there was obviously something weird going on in this area in remote middle of nowhere that raised Rosen's interest to the point that he went out and found Betty.
Yeah, it's such a shame you can't interview him. I would love to know what made him think that he knew where this woman might be.
Well, yeah. And then the other point being is that, so no mosquito bites. She wasn't dehydrated. She was being taken care of, at least indoors, for majority of this time frame.
Yeah, it can't be explained, but that's what all the evidence points to. Man. Another case, super weird as well. This case, you've kept the name and just called him John Doe, happened near Mount Shasta, which is known to have a lot of strange activity, especially in the UFO community. A lot of people talk about Mount Shasta sightings of weird things, but this is probably the most far out case, I would say, in terms of strange details.
So Mount Shasta, home to the Lemurians.
Yeah, of course.
people can look that up. But there's I got a call from a grandmother of this boy that was 3 years old. He was camping with his family along the McLeod River. And for people that don't know, I've actually fished the McLeod hundreds of times. Absolutely beautiful location, somewhat near the base of Mount Shasta, really thick, healthy woods, fantastic fishing. Everything about it is just first class. And he disappears, and he vanishes at about 6:30 p.m., and parents look all over. They can't find him. And they call in the sheriff. Everyone starts to look. About 5 hours later, they find him in a thicket directly adjoining a trail that they've been hiking up and down all night. And he seems to be okay. Nothing unusual about him. Make a long story short, he goes to his grandma's house the following night, and he tells her the story about what happened. And he says that he sort of wakes up in this cave. And he tells his grandma that he saw her twin. And she goes, well, what do you mean? And he goes, well, I just saw somebody in this cave. Looks just like you, Grandma. And she says, well, what happened? And he goes, well, I guess I was missing then. And I wake up in this cave with all of these robots in it. And these robots aren't moving. And this woman that looked just like you put some paper down on the ground of the cave and told me to poop in it. And he said, I didn't have to. And he said that she got upset and told him that you had to. And he said, I can't. And he said that originally I thought that was you, Grandma, until I saw sparks come out of your head. And he said, eventually the woman, there was a ladder that left the cave towards the ceiling, and there was light there. And he said that eventually she left, and then I woke up and I was on the trail. Now, when I spoke to the grandmother, the interesting part of this story is that she was camped in the same location 3 weeks earlier. And she woke up in the morning, and she had her partner, boyfriend, said that she had a blood spot on the back of her neck. And she said, I couldn't remember anything about it, but I remember him saying it because I guess it got on part of my shirt. And she says, I think it was weird that I was in the same location 3 weeks earlier with this blood spot. And she says, and my grandson doesn't really know to make up stories. He doesn't watch a lot of TV, and what he said really bothered everybody, especially since the parents couldn't believe he could disappear as quickly as he did. And then he shows up right next to the trail everyone's walking on. Now, missing people, another part of that profile is that when they're found in an area that had been searched or had been traveled by search and rescue people, sometimes dozens of times. And the search and rescue people can't understand how they missed them, or how they got back into that area without them being seen walking back in.
Yeah. Another weird, weird detail.
Very weird. It's almost as though they were placed there while the searchers were momentarily out of the area to be ensured that they would be found again. That's almost what it appears like.
Exactly. That is the implication. It seems pretty clear that the robots stealthily extracted the grandma's DNA to build a replica to convince this kid to poop on paper so they could get his DNA. It just seemed, that one seems like pretty wrapped up, I'd say. Case closed.
Yeah, that's, many people have said that.
Weird. And this last one, this guy, he did not, well, I'll just let you explain it. Charles McCullough, really strange case. You mentioned Crater Lake earlier, and this is one that took place there, pretty far out.
Yeah, this is one of the early cases that we got onto, and McCullough was from Virginia. It happened October 14, 1976. He was 19 years old. He wanted to make a trip around to the national parks before he started college. He was on his own, and he visited the lake And October 14, 76, there were 24 to 90 inches of normal snow depth around the lake with drifts to 20 feet. And if you've never been to Crater Lake, it's an absolutely gorgeous spot, and it looks substantially different winter to summer. And McCullough, many people verified he was at the lake on that date, and then nobody saw him. And his dad came out to file a missing persons report and then to give the National Park Service a list of items that Charles would have in his backpack, including his camera, some keys. He was there to photograph the park. He's one of a number of photographers that have disappeared in the wild. And in a newspaper article that I found on this incident, they talked about one of the rangers that looked for Charles. His name was Marion Jack, and Marion was a junior high school science teacher during the school year. And then during the summer, he would take his family up to Crater Lake, and he was a seasonal law enforcement ranger. Graduate of the Law Enforcement Training Center, absolutely one of the nicest men you would ever meet. And through some hard work, I found him, went and knocked on his door in Medford, and we ended up having a long, long conversation, and he invited me into his home, just a super, super guy. And he said, "Dave, this is really weird. I was a ranger for 30 years, and you asked me about the one case during my career that is the strangest anyone could imagine." He goes, "You did your homework, son." He goes, "Good job." And we had this conversation about McCullough. Well, a year after he disappears, there's some people during that summer months, they're in an area called the Bybee Creek drainage. And they're about 12 miles from the point where McCullough disappeared. And they're in a box canyon, and they come across something that made them uncomfortable, and they thought they found some bones and a skull. And they backed out, and they come back into Crater Lake, and they tell the Park Service. Well, Marion and another ranger get on horseback and they ride into the area. So Marion tells me that, he goes, "Dave, I've recovered probably 100 bodies in the woods." And he goes, "I've never had anything like this happen to me." And he goes, "I'll explain it the best I can." He says, "You walk into a box canyon with a very low flowing creek. There's a big Douglas fir tree. I step up to the top of it and I look down the other side. And I see a pair of Levi's with the buckle undone, the button undone, the zipper down, and it looks like it's pulled down to someone's socks that are sitting there. No shoes on the socks, no boots on the socks. And the only thing I could feel in the right leg is a broken tibia bone. I feel the socks, and there's little bones in the socks as though it was somebody's bones. But he says, there's no other bones around that I see on that side. So my partner and I start searching, and on the other side of the log, kind of behind us, is we see a series of bone chips, and we find that the cap of a skull and the lower part of a skull separated in that same area. He said, "Dave," he says, "I knew something was really, really wrong. We didn't know what to think of it, but we taped off the scene, we left, and we rode 12 miles back, we made a call, and we wanted an FBI evidence response team to fly in from Portland to work this scene because it isn't right." And he goes, "That's exactly what happened." He says, "We wrote lengthy reports about it, and coupled with the original missing person report, and I explained to Marion that the Park Service said they don't have those reports anymore." And he says, "That's impossible." I said, "Nope, they said they don't." And he goes, "Dave, that is not right." He goes, "They should still have this." I said, "Well, they never gave them up if they do have them." So the FBI flew in. They never found the camera. They never found the boy's knife. They found his backpack with his keys in it. They never found his coat or his shoes. And Marion said, in all those cases, he says, 100 cases I've worked in the woods, I found shoes in every one of those cases but this one. He says, those shoes couldn't have disappeared. He says, there's no way. asked him the million-dollar question. I said, how did he get 12 miles into the woods in the middle of winter? And he said, well, Dave, he didn't have snowshoes, and he didn't have skis, and there were no snowmobiles allowed in the park. He says, that is the million-dollar question right there. Where and how did he get in there in the middle of winter?
Damn. Some things in that case make me think of spontaneous human combustion, but you would still think his shoes would be nearby, and why would he be so far away?
Yeah, and that coupled with, you know, there's nothing burnt on the clothes. It's just a complete whodunit. His dad came out, McCullough's dad came out twice on other occasions and wrote a letter to his local congressman asking for the FBI to become involved, because even before Charles was found, his dad said, hey, he had to have been taken against his will. He's not the kind of guy to just disappear and do something random. And, I mean, all indications would be that it would be an impossible trek.
And if he was eaten by some kind of animal, his clothes would not be laid out like that.
Well, as Marion said, he said, Dave, imagine if you were standing up and you unbuckled your pants, you unzipped them, and you pushed your pants down to your ankles. That's the scene. And he said, but we never found any big bones. We never found any hip bones, shoulder blades, femurs, nothing like that.
Just one half of a tibia bone. Weird. And some small fragments.
And it's very, very small fragments of bone scattered on the other side of the Douglas fir tree.
Man. And obviously you have more cases than we could ever discuss in these books, and they are super interesting. Case after case, it's just a fascinating read. I wanted to ask you a little more about the commonalities, because there are some that aren't involved in the cases we've talked about. Some involve boulder fields, large bodies of water. What are some of the other ones that might not have come into play very much in this conversation?
Berries. And we talked about it in one case, but in many of the cases, berries are involved, meaning there's a lot of berry pickers that have disappeared. People eating berries are found. That's one. There's even age classifications. I try to break it down by kids 10 years and younger. There aren't a lot of people that have disappeared in that middle age bracket, say from 30 to 50. But then there's many in that older age bracket and the younger. And then there's the clustering effect of these disappearances. Now, not all people disappear inside of a cluster, but there's a lot that do. And the clusters predominantly run along the western U.S., up to Canada, back down around Idaho, Montana, and then down through the Rocky Mountains all the way to Arizona. But there's a middle section of the United States that almost has nothing in it, which is pretty unusual. And then if you follow the Appalachian Trail from, say, Great Smoky Mountain National Park directly up the eastern part of the U.S., there's a vast amount of disappearances and clusters in that area. And then most recently, we've mapped a series of clusters around the Great Lakes. So the two important pieces to the clusters, mountains and water.
Strange. All these things leave me so speechless, because you do such a great job of laying out the details. It's just, all I can say is that's weird. But do you find that this information is getting more attention now that you've been spreading the word for a few years?
I think that there is more visibility to it, but it's at a snail's pace. And it's a bit frustrating, because I'm not somebody who goes out on a limb to say some wild things. I try to stay straight to the facts and keep an open mind. So I'm not claiming anything wild is happening or that there's some strange issue at stake, but the facts do dictate that there is something abnormal that's happened. And it's too bad that certain media outlets aren't willing to talk about it.
Right. Yeah, it's a serious shame. I mean, this should be one of the most important things. It involves people dying and we don't know why. Isn't that national security? You know, everyone's worried about terrorism globally. Well, here's people going missing right in our own backyard and we don't know what's going on and we don't know who to blame. And you would think that they dedicate a little bit of resources to that.
Well, you'd hope, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Right, right. Well, David, this has been awesome. It's about that time we called in. It's been a fascinating show. Thanks so much for being here. I mean, several listeners have requested that you come on, and you're the only one doing this, so I'm very appreciative. But before we go, would you like to tell the people a little bit about your website, where to get the books, and maybe what your plans are for the future with this stuff?
So you can go to our website. It's canammissing.com, and all four books, Missing 411, as the title of all four books, are available on the site. You can also read about cases that are occurring as we speak under current events section at the site. We try to keep it updated with things that are relevant and fit the profile. I don't know if there'll be another book anytime in the near future, but we are looking into some other venues to get this message out. We are going to continue the work, and the only way the work continues is through the support of people out there in buying the books. So it's people like you, Greg, that help us get the word out and have read the work and understand that this is a credible issue that needs some attention. So I appreciate that.
Oh, absolutely, man. Thank you for that. And I would recommend them to anyone. I read the third one, and I've heard many cases from the first two. And just hearing now that you've got a fourth one, I'm super excited to dig into that. It's super interesting stuff and far different from a lot of the things that are similar in this realm of fringe topics that I get into. So I appreciate it. And the families, I'm sure, appreciate what you're doing, too. But thanks again. You know, keep doing it. Be careful out there, man. You're digging up a lot of stuff that some powerful people seem to want to stay hidden. So make sure you take care of yourself.
I appreciate it, Greg, and I'll try.
All right, man. Have a good one.
Thank you, sir.
You got it. There we have it, people. Man, I love this show. Dave is so good at giving the details of these cases, and it's really an unsolved mystery and something fresh for conspiracy fans, although that sounds a bit morbid. And it was a lot more work than normal to comb through and pull out specific cases that had enough links to present them as not just isolated incidents. So in the first hour, the commonality I latched onto was young kids disappearing and being found many miles away. And Jesus, how creepy is that? And then for the second hour, the main commonality I tried to focus on was people who survived that mentioned strange things about their missing time, meeting dog men and robots and grandma's clone or hiding from the people. Really weird. And if you only heard the first half and you liked it, please consider supporting me and the show with just $5 a month, and I'll support you with a longer episode. I could really use some more signups. It is a pretty crucial point, but thanks to everyone who has. I mean, we're only on the second show of Plus, so to support it this early really does mean a lot. And there were some other cool things that came out of the second hour today, too, like the Bermuda Triangle connection and David's breakdown of the percentage of found alive versus dead or never found. And, you know, I'm really stuck in a bit of a rough place because I want to just give the show to everyone, but I also need to bring in money. And the response has been super understanding and positive. But a few folks have told me they'll never listen again or I've sold out, which is kind of unfair because I think I've done a lot of free work and it is my passion. I don't really mind, but when it is getting in the way of life's necessities, I got to do something. And we're still doing the money bomb on the last show of every month. You know, five shows a month. The last one will be a money bomb winner. So for people to just be like, give me free shit forever or fuck off, that really sours my hope for humanity on a grand scale. Yet some other people are pissed that the first hour is now just a commercial for the second hour. And I don't want it to be like that either. I think these first hours can be appreciated on their own, but I have to inform the people about what's in the second hour. I have to remind listeners that the second hour exists and I'm trying to survive on it and it's available. But we're in transition, and I'm kind of smoothing out the edges as we go. But the core of the show, which is great interviews, has and will always remain intact as long as there is weirdness and corruption in the world and people who support my adventure in investigating it. And if you really, I almost regret saying this, but if you really don't think you can afford $5 a month,
email me and maybe we can talk. Also, keep sending your music in, people. I've got great plans to create the podcast music archive that helps both the artists and the independent podcasters out there, and I think it's going to be a great fusion. So keep sending me that stuff so I can build it up, go to other podcasters, ask them to do the same for their audience, create a big archive that all these producers have access to, and then independent musicians can start hearing their tracks all over the goddamn net. It could be really cool. But that's it for me this week. I've done my part. Your move, wild men of the deep, dark redwoods and beyond. Your fucking move.
The Higher Side Cast is where it's at. With everything you need to know, from corruption to you.